Last time I kept some 6 inches from my face, I got arrested. My name's Cricket, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, y'all. My sobriety date is October the 19th of 1969, and I'm truly, truly grateful for that. You should be grateful, too. I'm unpleasant sober. You ought to see me drunk. No, you shouldn't. I'd like to thank you for wanting me to be with you. I was here 6 years ago, and it was a marvelous experience. And I'm back again, and it's another marvelous experience. And I'd like to thank my dear friend Liz for making that long drive from Illinois down here with me and being such a, not just such a dear friend, but she's my first and only Polish sponsoree. And it's wonderful. You know, I told God when I can no longer be of service to others, then my day is done. And I moved to Illinois, and I still get to be of service, and that's a marvelous experience. I will share with you in a general way, just like it tells us to, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I was born into a family that's a little bit different. I do not like labels. So I'm not going to tell you we were dysfunctional, because we weren't. We functioned well, just different. My mother's full-blooded Black Irish. She believes that one child in every family is born evil. They're born possessed. And you determine it by the weight at birth. The least weighing child is evil, and I weighed 2.5 pounds when I was born. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was evil, and I was possessed. My natural father was a full-blooded Frenchman. And the only knowledge I have of him is that he's very, very potent because he sired 17 children. He believed in the spirit of rotation. He believed in planting the seed. And none of us knew him, you know. And that's okay. I didn't miss not knowing him. My mother was very, very fortunate. She married a gentleman. And this is way back in the early 40s, y'all, so some of you can't even imagine what it was like, and others can. We made our living following crops across the United States of America. And I have to tell you, it was a wonderful way of life. I loved following the crops. I loved picking the vegetables. I loved picking the fruit. I loved the secret of knowing that if there's a crack in the ground in a potato garden, if I dig down through that crack, I'm going to find a whole potato. You know, there's a lot of secrets in that kind of society that most people are not blessed to know. I developed a friendship with soil, with the dirt of the earth, that I've never lost. To this day, I still have that friendship with the dirt of the earth, and I love it. The only thing that I did not like about following crops is that every time the picking season changed, we had to move. And every time we moved, we had to start a new school. And every time we started a new school, we didn't fit in. You were frightened of us. You didn't understand the culture of the crop follower. You didn't understand our lifestyle. So your normal reaction was, uh-oh, stay away from them. They're bad. They're bad people. Just simply because we were different. Some of us were bad, but not all of the crop followers were bad. We didn't have some very, very necessary things that people take for granted today. We didn't have indoor plumbing. We didn't have electricity. And so I had horrible skin and rotten teeth. And I had long, curly, nappy, dirty hair. And as we changed schools and as we followed crops, we went to church. And I love it when alcoholics say that they went to church on a regular basis. We did too. We went twice a year, every year. And we went at Thanksgiving time, y'all, and we went at Christmas. Now, let me tell you why. Because at Thanksgiving and Christmas, preachers would stand behind a pulpit, and they would tell their congregation that they needed to be nice to the people less fortunate. They need to be kind and giving. The first 10 months of the year didn't count. But Thanksgiving and Christmas, you got to get off of it and share. And if we listen to this preacher all the way through his sermon, they gave us a great big old wicker basket filled with goodies. And it might even have a Crayolas and coloring books and things like that in it. And we had to listen to that sermon all the way through. And at this time, the time that I remember the most, I was probably about 10 years of age, and I'm listening to this preacher guy. And he's up there and he's saying, anything I prayed for in the name of Jesus, I'd receive. And I really got excited. Now, we're not a family that had toys. We didn't have those kind of things, but my heart started beating fast. And I thought to myself, anything I pray for in the name of Jesus, I'll get. And the man was behind a pulpit. And he was dressed. And he was clean. And he even smelled good. So he had to be telling the truth. And I remember going home from church that day and finding a mirror in the house. And if you ever were familiar with Crop Followers, they assign you living quarters, and it's one room in a little kitchenette. And I found this mirror, and I remember looking in it and finding a place on my face that didn't have a zit because we didn't bathe very often. And I put my finger on that place, and I said, in the name of Jesus, when I wake up in the morning, make the rest of my face as clear as this spot is right here. Because see, if the outside of me were different, you would allow your children to play with me. If the outside of me were different, you wouldn't turn away when you looked at me. If the outside were different, I wouldn't have to cover my face with my hands. I would, you know, if just this were different, I'd be okay. And I got all excited. I went to bed that night, y'all. I woke up in the morning. My heart was beating fast. I thought, it's going to be a good day. I'm going to be different. And I ran to the mirror, and there was a zit right where I prayed. See? And you know what that told me? Jesus didn't like me. That's what that told me. I found a place in my home at this time. We wound up in Denver, Colorado, because my stepfather could no longer follow crops. And I found a place in my home, and I called it my safe place. And it was behind the old wood stove. And you know what? I could crawl behind that old wood stove, and I could pretend me away. My hair would be a different color. My eyes would be a different color. My skin would be a different color. Everything about me on the outside would be different. Because if that was okay, then you would allow your children to play with me. If that was okay, I wouldn't have to hide away from you. And I stayed behind that wood stove, and I just pretended and pretended and pretended. A few months later, a few weeks later, two of my older brothers came to me. They were professional men. They were armed robbers. And they came to me with a business agreement. If I didn't tell what they were doing, they would give me a prize. And I love prizes. To this day, I get excited when I get prizes, y'all. I really do. Because my family never gave prizes. And they gave me a prize, and it came in a brown paper sack. And it was a little pint bottle. I'd never seen the likes of it in my life. And I sat there, and I remember thinking, I don't know what this is. I knew that they hid their money, and I knew that they hid their guns in a hole behind the stove. And so I remember opening that bottle up, and I remember sitting there, and I must have been 12 years of age, and I took my first drink of whiskey. And I remember how that burned. It burned my throat. It burned my stomach. It burned all the way down. It burned all the way back up again. And it burned all the way back down again. And I drank it until the bottle was empty. And an amazing thing happened. I didn't have to pretend anymore. I went to God with a prayer, and I remember it verbatim. Dear God, sir, my name is Cricket, and I don't believe in you. And I don't believe in family. I don't believe in cleanliness. And I don't believe in goodness. But just in case you are, this is my very last prayer to you. Help me to never feel again. And big boy, I don't want any favors. I don't even want to feel good. By the time I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1969, that prayer was answered in its entirety. I left home at the age of 12, started living on the streets of Denver, Colorado, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. When I tell you I know what it's like to live under a bridge, I know what it's like to live under a bridge. I know what it's like to dig food out of a garbage barrel and scrape stuff off of it to eat it and be grateful for it. I know what that feeling's like. I know what it's like to look down on the ground to try to find a quarter. I know what it's like to dig in the slots on the telephones. I know what it's like to cut the fingertips off of my gloves so I could pick something up to eat easier. I know what that lifestyle's like. And let me tell you something. It has a beauty and a majesty all of its own. And I used to get real offended when people would say, oh, but there but for the grace of God go I. See, God's grace was on me even then. I just didn't know it. I never look at anybody and say, there but for the grace of God go I, because that puts me above where they're at. And I'm not, y'all. Never have been, never want to be. I lived like that for a few months and the state of Colorado interfered. They did not recognize teenage alcoholism. They said I was incorrigible. They took me from the streets of Denver to the Colorado State Reform School in Morrison, Colorado. And they took me into this building. They assigned me to a room. There was one bed in that room, one person in that bed, two sheets on that bed. There was an indoor toilet. There was electricity. There was a great big white bathtub. They gave me a toothbrush and I didn't know what it was. And I loved being punished. I'd never had any of those things in my life. It was amazing. For the next year, I was punished, and I guess I became corrigible because they released me. I went right back to the streets of Denver, Colorado, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. At the age of 16, the state of Colorado interfered one more time. They took me to the Colorado State Insane Asylum in Pueblo, Colorado. And because they did not recognize teenage alcoholism, they had to diagnose me. They diagnosed me as schizophrenic with paranoid reaction with psychotic tendencies, and I thought, hot dog. I'm only 16, you know, and I didn't even know what I was being called. You know, that's why I don't like labels. I was sober several years, and my sponsor said, in your case, schizophrenic means you're two-faced, and you are. Paranoid means you think people talk behind your back, and they do. And psychotic means that you'd rather kill them than yourself, and I still would, you know. So I guess I'm always going to have a little bit of that psychotic, because I'd rather see anyone in this room, as much as I love some of the people here, I'd rather see any one of y'all get drunk than me, you know. I'm sorry. I got one shot at sobriety. I can't game it. I can't go in and out that door. I can't. I got to hit a bottom before I get here. When I get here, at some point, while I still have breath to take to learn how to live sober one day at a time, so I can't do the in and out. I just can't do that. Thank you, God. In the Colorado State Insane Asylum, to make me not be those things, four times a day, they gave me 10 milligrams of Valium, 25 milligrams of Librium, and 50 milligrams of Thorazine. The desire to drink was removed. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, they laid me on a gurney and they wheeled me into a room called the electric shock treatment room. Three times a week for 18 months of my life, they administered electric shocks to me. Sometimes we had to be medically resuscitated. I have brain damage as a result of that experience, and I like my brain damage, y'all. You know, I really do. When people talk about some of us are sicker than others, I think that would be me. Some of us suffer from grave emotional mental disorder. Me too, you know. But see, let me tell you the key to that. I don't use what's wrong with me as a cover-up for my character defects. I don't do what I do, behave the way I behave, for any reason other than the fact that I have character defects that I need to clean up and get rid of. And I do that through the help of a sponsor working the steps of recovery and God as I understand him. That's the way it works for me and the people I sponsor. I left that Colorado State Insane Asylum. I was released a week prior to my 18th birthday. I weighed approximately 300 pounds. I could not get out into the sunshine because of the effects of the Thorazine. And I did that walk that people make fun of that you call the Thorazine shuffle. But it was the only way I had to get from point one to point two. Had no other way. I wasn't shuffling so that you would shake your head in pity or that you would laugh at me. I was shuffling because that's the only way my body would move. I couldn't speak. My head laid on my shoulder and I drooled. Eventually, my head came back up. Eventually, I could walk more like other people. Eventually, I quit the drooling. The speech returned, and all of that took time. And believe it or not, when I left that state insane asylum, I went right back to the streets of Denver, Colorado, doing whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. Had I stayed one more week in that state hospital, the state had sanctioned a sterilization. Now, let me tell you why I'm glad I didn't stay that week. I have a daughter that was born in 1978, who's absolutely an amazing gift from God. And with 8 years of continuous sobriety, God allowed me to be her home. He allowed me to have her inside of me for 9 long months. And he made room in my body. I mean, he made my body just grow and grow and grow so I could hold her the right way. And then I got to give birth to that little girl. I got to bring her into the world. And I got to take her home from the hospital. And I got to take her into the Rainbow House, a house that I was paid for, a house that I kept clean. And I got to let her live there every day of her life until she was 21 years old and left home to get married. I got to do that. And you think that's not a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous? It was a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I left that state hospital and started doing whatever I had to do, I never had a desire to do anything else except die what I was, a drunken slut on the street of some city somewhere. And it didn't matter where. I didn't care. My prayer had been answered. I traveled all across the United States hitchhiking, riding a Greyhound bus, the old Continental bus line. I did whatever I had to do to get that next drink of alcohol. I wound up back in Denver, Colorado, in the middle of 1969, maybe it was 68, did what I knew best, found a beer joint. You know, I'm not a bar drinker, y'all, and I'm definitely not a club woman. I'm a beer joint woman. And let me tell you why I like them. I like the stools. Have y'all ever been in a beer joint? And they've got them plastic red stools, and they put that gray tape on them to hold the stuffings in. They don't replace the stools, they tape it. And there's burn marks, and there's music, and it's dark. The only time there's light is about 5 in the evening when your husbands stop off on their way home from work to have one. You know, and that's a marvelous experience. I loved entertaining your husbands. They were so cute. You know, I don't think men are stupid. I think they're desperate. Because they come in that beer joint and they'd scope the bar. And they look for that woman unattended. And then they come down and they keep a seat between you and them, usually. And they make this wonderful sound. These poor you women just weren't doing what you were supposed to do. They make this wonderful, oh. It's amazing. And you look over at this man and you say, what's the matter? Oh, lady, if you only knew. Now, I've already heard this from several other men that week. And I said, well, tell me, maybe I can understand. Work all day. All I want to do is go home, take care of the wife and kids. And I stop off and have one drink. And when I walk in that door, she's going to be net, 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 net. Can't do enough to please her. She spends the money. She goes here. She goes there. All I want is one drink. And you look at him and you say, you know what? If I had a man like you, I'd know how to treat him. Oh, then they became dear. Lady, would you like to have a drink? Oh, thank you. You know, I was getting what I want. They got what they wanted. And let me tell you where they went. They went home to you. So let me tell you who they cared about. They cared about you. Let me tell you where their heart lied. It lied with you. Alcoholism is cunning, baffling, powerful, and it sets out to destroy marriages, and it does it effectively. I like to believe, maybe I'm wrong, I like to believe that I saved marriages. You know, a couple good evenings with me, and they were ready to go home to mama. I used to be a street vendor. They never arrested me for that. They called it something else. I'll tell y'all what, when I get overly tired, I get a little risque. So, and I'm just plain nasty when I'm not overly tired. I liked that lifestyle. And being real honest with you, I would crawl up on my bar stool and just let the world go away. I didn't communicate except with the men. I didn't start trouble. I stayed away from you. Just leave me alone. I was in this beer joint called the Red Beret on East Colfax in Denver, Colorado, the night before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And a man and his wife approached me. And he said, Cricket, my wife and I have watched you for several months, and we think you have a problem drinking. And I said, I don't have a problem drinking, big boy. He said, I'll make a deal with you. If you'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with us tomorrow night and we find out you don't have a problem drinking, we'll leave you alone. I said, okay, big boy. He said, now do me a favor. When you get up in the morning, don't take a drink of anything containing alcohol. I said, no problem. I weighed 78 pounds. My teeth were rotted out of my head. I went to my sister's home. She gave him her phone number. I was going to spend the night with her. The next morning I woke up, did the only thing I knew how to do. I reached for my little bottle of whiskey, and I could not take that first drink that day. Today I understand that was God doing for Cricket what she could not do for herself. Do not misunderstand me. I got violently, physically ill, not drinking. It was a nightmare I got so sick, not being able to take that first drink. That idiot called my sister's house about noon. And she put me on the phone and he said, hi, this is Harry. I said, and? He said, do you need a ride to the meeting? I said, let me tell you something, fool. I told you I'd be at your meeting, but I don't need anything from you. I will be at your meeting. I'd never driven a car before I got sober. I didn't have the type of employment you pay taxes on. So I told my sister later on in the day that I was going to this 8 o'clock meeting, and I called a yellow cab. The yellow cab came and got me and took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never will forget it. The closer we got, the more embarrassed I got. I thought, what in the world does the word anonymous mean? That I've never heard that word. What's it mean? And I thought, I don't know. I better not let anybody see me going in that door. And so I had the taxi cab let me off about a half a block away from the AA club. And when it turned the corner and I could no longer see its taillights in the snow, I walked into my first meeting at 1311 York Street in Denver, Colorado. Oh, and let me tell y'all something. Nastiest place I've ever been in my life. You know, I walked in. Now, I came into AA with two prejudices. I did not like red-haired women, and I didn't like lesbians. And so I'd hit them. You know, that's what you do. My first AA meeting, everybody in there smelled really different. And I think it's because they'd all bathed that day. You know, I understand that smell today. It's refreshing. It's called cleanliness. But then it was offensive. You know, when you stink real bad, the person next to you smells right, you think they're wrong. And that's just the way it is. I walked in there. People were laughing, and a redheaded lady came walking up to me, and she said, "Hi, my name's Sharon. Are you an alky?" Oh, I was horrified, so I knocked her on her rear end. A few minutes later, one of the men came up to me, to her, and he said, "Sharon, have you told Cricket that we care?" And she said, "Not yet." You know, and I was so good for that group, y'all. I sit on the very back row, and when I was a newcomer, they passed the wicker baskets, and they said, "If you've got it, put it in. If you need it, take it out." Woo! That was good pay that night. I stole AA basket money for 6 straight months. You know, I followed their instructions. They said, "Take what you need now. What you don't need now, come back and get later." I broke into the office at the clubhouse, stole all the office equipment, took it down to the pawn shop, and hawked it. Now, I'm not drinking. See, I haven't drank anything containing alcohol since the day I walked in the door. So I'm sober doing this stuff. Went in, I stole their stuff, I sold their stuff, and I went back. I've got 3 weeks. Getting ready to break into their Coke machine. I've got my crowbar. I want the money, and I want a cold drink. You know, I saw people fiddling around over there. I thought, "Get out of the way. I'll open it for you." Old habits die hard. You know, they just die hard. I'm sitting at that Coke machine prying it open, and here comes some of those people. And every group has them. You know, they're the ones that tell you how it is. They're the ones who tell you what you don't want to hear. They're the ones who care enough to keep it going. They're the ones you probably don't even like. But they're the ones that they're the pulse. They're what we need to keep us beating the right way. They told me there were several of them. They said, "Cricket, we're not going to tolerate your behavior anymore." And I thought, "You think?" And I thought they were going to kick me out, and I got really excited inside. You know, gosh, I've been sober 3 weeks. Alcoholics Anonymous is going to kick me out. I can go drink. And my heart was beating fast, and they said, "We want to kick you out." And they said, "But our traditions won't allow us to." I thought, "What's a tradition? It sounds like a social disease. Why would you be passing it around?" You know, I'd never heard that word, just like anonymity. And I said, "What?" And they said, "Our traditions won't allow us to." And I said, "Well, what are you going to do, big boys?" And they said, "Cricket, from now on, you have to bring back the money you've panhandled. You have to take your price list back from the AA men." I said, "No way." But I did. "You can no longer turn over tables in a discussion meeting. You can't hit people you don't like. You know, all these rules and regulations." And I said, "Well, what are you boys going to do about it?" Let me tell you what they did for the next 5.5 months of my sobriety. When I got to the door of Alcoholics Anonymous every night, 2 men escorted me to my chair. They sat beside me during the meeting, and they escorted me out the door. See, I can't lose. I don't want to look weak to Harry. And if I just go and get drunk, I'm going to look weak. If AA kicks me out, then AA looks bad, not me. Sick thinking, but in my head, that's the way I thought. I stayed sober at that group for 6 more months. I was approached by the Narcotics Division of the Denver Police Force and told I had to leave Denver. And I said, "You know, I've done absolutely nothing for 6 months. And they said, "Well, you have to leave." And I said, "Okay. Where am I going, big boys?" And they said, "Cricket, you're moving to Fort Worth, Texas." I said, "Well, wait a minute. Drunk, I didn't go to Texas." And they said, "That was why." I said, "Okay, I'll go on 3 conditions. I've got a fourth grade education, y'all. I said, what are those three conditions? They said, what are those three conditions? I said, I want a high school diploma. They said, okay. I said, and I've heard about Texas and what they use for toilet paper. They use corn cobs. So I want a case of the softest toilet paper made by mankind. Now, I really believed it back then, y'all. I really believed it in my head, just like the little girl believed the preacher. And I said, and I want a car with a driver's license. So I'd gotten a ticket. Don't misunderstand. I got a ticket because I got drunk in a shopping cart in St. Joe, Missouri on a hill. Now, I don't know if you all understand what a shopping cart with a drunk woman going downhill does. You can't control the speed. I can't control my Liz's speed in a car. You can't control my speed in a shopping cart. And we're going faster. I'm going faster and faster and faster. Can't steer it. Can't stop it. So when the cops got me at the bottom of the hill, I got a ticket for driving a non-motorized vehicle under the influence of alcohol. These cops bought me a 58 Rambler station wagon. Great big old green thing. They took me to this lady. She read me questions for 30 minutes and said, congratulations, you passed your GED. They bought me a case of really soft toilet paper. And I had to go and take my driving test. And I went day after day after day. Because, see, it was really confusing. I've got two legs. That car had three pedals. I couldn't figure out what they were wanting me to do. I mean, I was supposed to push down and let up at the same time and keep this hand up here doing something and this hand over. It was cunning, baffling, and powerful. I have got the most wonderful car in the world. It says D, drive, R, reverse, P, park. That's all I need. I don't need any more information. That's the way my AA program works. I've got my books. I don't need all this other stuff, you know, that people tell you about. I don't need it. You may need it, but I don't need all that self-help stuff. I self-help myself into a drunk if I get too confused with it. They got me all that stuff. One day I went in to take my driving test, and they all looked at one another and said they weren't getting in the car with me. One brave old soul did. We went out and got in the car, and he said, Cricket, crank it up. And I turned that ignition, and it came on. He said, congratulations, you passed your driving test. I got in that car with my toilet paper, my GED, and my sister, and we drove from Denver, Colorado, straight through to Fort Worth, Texas. Now, y'all, I don't know if you've ever driven across Texas, but you could actually go off the end of the world. It just goes on forever and ever and flat, just flat. And I thought, oh, my God. And we're driving down this road, and my sister says to me, look, sis, there's a little beer joint called the Lucky Lady. And I said, we need to find a home near here because them alcoholics in Texas use corn cobs. They're not going to know about traditions. I can get kicked out. And she said, okay. And we found a little one-room place, my sister and me, Efficiency, right above a little grocery store, right next door to the Lucky Lady beer joint. It was on the far east side of Fort Worth, Texas. And I went down and I'd done something to that car. I didn't know about oil and stuff. You know, I'd cracked a block or did something, but the car never went anywhere again. So I called Southwest Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is in April of 1970. And they answered the phone. Southwest Group AA. You know, that's a sick way to answer an AA phone. You're just supposed to say, Alcoholics Anonymous, what do you want? You know, something that they can identify with. And I said, I need directions to your meeting. He said, do you need a ride? I said, is that what I ask you for, big boy? I just need directions to your meeting. So he gave me directions, and I hitchhiked from the far east side of Fort Worth, Texas, to the far southwest side, walked into my first Texas AA meeting, and a redheaded lady come walking up to me. Y'all, now really, seriously, she was nasty. She said, hello, darling. Ooh, I still get the creepy crawlies. And she started to hug me. So I knocked her on her rear end. This group, just like the first group, started having emergency groups conscience, studying the traditions, they came to me and asked me, they installed a floor safe after I'd been going for a little while. Then they came back and said, how do we keep you out of there? Now, I stayed sober at that group for 7 years. Somebody copped a resentment. They went in and they torched the group. I have to tell you, I have never set an AA group on fire yet. I just haven't. Some people still believe I did. I met and married my first husband in Alcoholics Anonymous at that group. He's a wonderful friend today. In fact, I've had 12 husbands since I got sober. Two of them were my own. Y'all, let me tell you what happened, though. They burned that group, and I couldn't make the move with the group. The group had to find a new location, and I couldn't do it. And so I went to the Harbor Club. And I'd heard about the club since the day I moved to Fort Worth. They don't accept women like me. You know, they don't want those type of people in their club. But I had no choice. So I walked into Harbor Club, and a redheaded lady came walking up to me. And she looked at me and she said, Cricket, my name's Betty G, and I'm going to be your sponsor. And I said, wait a minute, woman. I've been sober several years. She said, oh, and I'm not taking anything away from that. You have been sober several years. I'll make a deal with you. Let's go back here in the office of the club. And if I think you understand the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is outlined in the first 164 pages, I'll leave you alone. I said, okay. We went back into the office, and Betty G. opened up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. She handed it across the desk to me, and she said, please read me the first portion of chapter 5. And I started reading it to her, and I read all the way through the ABCs. And she took the big book of AA out of my hand, y'all, and she said, Cricket, you can't read. I said, excuse me, woman, I just read you the first portion of chapter 5. She said, no, darling, I had it open on chapter 3. You've heard it at every meeting, day after day after day, and you have it memorized. And I looked at her and I said, what are you going to do with that information? And she said, I'm going to take you to the TCU, which is Texas Christian University. She took me to a thing called remedial reading. At the age of 38, I started learning how to read. I gave birth to that first and only child of mine. And let me tell you what those men and women that didn't want me in their group, because I dressed different, I smelled different, I was uneducated, let me tell you what they did. They breathed life into me. They set me at their coffee table and taught me to pick up the book and learn how to mouth those words. And I can pick up any book written in English almost and read it. And if I don't know what a word means, I sound it out, I look it up in the dictionary. I know how to read today. They taught me to change the way I dressed. They taught me how to use more than just a spoon at the table. They taught me how to honor you by saying, yes, ma'am. It's not because of your age. I do it to little bitty children. Yes, sir. I do it to little bitty men. Do you know why? Because I'm honoring what God created. That's all it is. Yes, ma'am, you deserve that. Yes, sir, you deserve that. Not because of who you are, but because God made you who you are. Because God made you what you are. And God has given you a way out on which you can absolutely rely. She made me quit stealing. My sponsor had never been told, you don't tell your sponsorees what to do. No one ever gave her that message. Let me tell you, the big book says, normally people who would not mix. She was a judge's daughter. I'm a crop follower's kid. She had a master's degree. I've got a fourth grade education. She went to finishing school. I went to reform school. She did Red Cross volunteer work. I went to the insane asylum. And she loved me more than anybody she had ever sponsored in her life. She was a grandmother that my daughter never had. The men and women at Harbor told me when I called them and said, come and get this baby. And they said, why? I said, because I'm going to hurt her. And see, when I start, I'm not going to be able to stop me. And those Al-Anon women and those men came into my home and they said, Cricket, when that monster starts panting and breathing and taking over behind your eyes and your head and your body starts getting tense and you know you're going to hurt somebody, you walk out of the house, put the baby in the crib, and you go outside. I can truthfully stand before you and say, my daughter has never laid in the floor and seen my foot coming upside her head. I have never called my daughter a dirty name. I have never told her I hated her. I have picked her up when she fell down. I have caressed her when she was lonely. My sponsor at this time became very, very ill. And we knew she was dying. And everybody kept telling me she was dying. And I went back before God with a prayer. And I can tell you what the prayer was. Dear God, sir, my name is Cricket. And sir, I kind of believe in you now. And I definitely believe in familyness. And I do believe in goodness, sir. And I believe in cleanliness. Because see, that little rainbow house that I was buying, my daughter stayed there and grew there. No two rooms were the same color. Hardwood floors, windows all over. You know, I wanted the light of God to come in, and I wanted the light of God to go out. You know, and I had that. I had that. And I said, sir, if there's any way possible, could you help me feel again? And I know I may have to feel bad, but please help me feel again. See, inside of me, when I hold those people's hands during the Lord's Prayer, I have to run and wash it off afterwards because it feels so creepy and crawly on me. And I don't care if any of those people get drunk. I don't care if somebody dies. Will you help me feel again, sir? And I will tell you that prayer was answered in its entirety. I had a key to my sponsor's home. I had the key to her car. I could write checks on her checking account. She had something called CDs. You don't play music. They're a piece of paper. And I could sign on CDs or something. Never took a dime from that woman. Never violated. You know what the greatest gift she gave me? Was that she believed inside of me there was a good. Inside of me, there was a good. She took me to an amazing place, and it's called Step One of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know how exciting it is? Do you know how exciting it is to know that I'm an alcoholic and my life's unmanageable? How thrilling to be able to come to believe that a power greater than me can restore me to sanity. See, I was a jigsaw puzzle, y'all. I got here, and all the pieces were all shook up and dumped out in the middle of that floor down at Harbor Club, that floor that didn't respect people like me. It was all dumped out there, and you started putting it together, and you did like most people do. You put the outside together, clean up the way Cricket dresses, make her fix her hair different, make her take off some of the makeup. Let's refine the outside of Cricket. And you know what God did? He said, that's okay. Y'all be about the business of fixing up the outside. And that one little piece that's missing out of every jigsaw puzzle that people hunt and search for, God said, I got it. And at that point in my life, he took out me my heart of stone and put in me my heart of flesh. I will tell you that the day came when I had to do the steps, the rest of the steps, and I had to make amends. And she didn't allow me to just make living amends. Stopping my behavior was not enough. I had to make direct amends wherever possible. As I worked through that journey, that wonderful, magnificent journey, my sponsor got sicker and sicker and sicker. My daughter and I went over there one day to do her breakfast because I went over every day. I did her breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I did her laundry. I got to take her to the doctor, y'all. I got to do that for my sponsor. And I went over one night on Valentine's, and I took her 6 live yellow tulips, and I put them in a vase beside her bed. I put her in a lavender nightgown from Kmart, She'd never had anything from Kmart in her life. But she wanted a lavender nightgown. I put her in that lavender nightgown. I took her upstairs after I fed her sausage and biscuits. And I tucked that magnificent, elegant, red-headed woman. I mean, she was tall. Tucked her in her bed. And she looked up at me. And you know how God etches our face as we get older. He cracks us. And he's so gentle that we don't even feel him doing the cracking. And she was all cracked on the cheeks. And a tear was running down my sponsor's cheek in one of them cracks. And I thought, where's that coming from? And I tried to trace it back. The tears of your sponsor come from so far, you can never trace them back. They come from so deep down inside. She looked me in my eyes, and I don't know how many times she'd said it before. And she said, Cricket, darling, you know I love you. For the very first time, I looked at my sponsor, and I said, Betty G., I love you too. And then I ran out of her apartment. And I went back the next morning, my daughter and me. And I went upstairs and found my sponsor on her bathroom floor in her lavender nightgown dead. And I knelt down beside her. And I thought to myself, oh, Betty, what do I do? You know, what do you do when you lose someone you love? What do you do? How do you go on? And you know what I did? I knelt down beside her and I wrapped my arms around her and I vowed that I would pick up the spiritual toolkit she had laid out for me and I would go on and try to be of maximum service to God and others till the last day of my life. And I would honor the things she had taught me. I would not violate the commandments because I violated every commandment. And to the best of my ability, I would not do that any longer. And I would be as good of an Alcoholics Anonymous member as I could possibly be. I would be the best mother I knew how to be. I would be a good neighbor and I would be a good citizen. I sponsor three wonderful red-haired women. I sponsor several lesbian women. I sponsor a gay man. I sponsor Spanish people and I sponsor black people. And I sponsor a Polish. You know, do you know how good that feels? God took that 78-pound freak, that nothing. He took that woman that was an absolute nothing and brought me in here and gave me the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship of Recovery, the steps that laid it all out, taught me about the traditions and the concepts, and he made me whole. I can lie my head on a pillow at night. And guess what? The storms are no longer there. A few years ago, when I had that little rainbow house, some Spanish girls moved in across the street. The woman who could not read, I got to teach the little Mexican kids in the neighborhood how to read. I got to teach them how to write. Before I moved to Illinois, one of them came running across the street and said, Miss Cricket, Miss Cricket. I said, what is it, Marty Saul? And she said, Miss Cricket, we got an A on our report card. You know, we got an A on our report card. My heart went right to my throat. I was diagnosed a few years ago with gastrointestinal cancer. And the doctor told me at that time I had 6 months to live. I'm still alive. And I'm still going. You know, I had to leave Fort Worth. I have a doctor in Illinois that, because I had no insurance, I'd gotten severely into debt because of medical stuff. I have a doctor in Illinois that helps me a lot in that way. Above and beyond that, something about the difference in the climate is better for my health. And the lady that was writing my book lived in Illinois and wanted me to be there so that she could finish the book while I was alive, and she finished it, and I'm still alive. I didn't know that when I walked out of that rainbow house, I couldn't step on those hardwood floors no more, y'all. Kids learned to roller skate on my hardwood floors. I didn't know that I couldn't wash the windows in that little yellow house. It didn't dawn on me that somebody would come in and paint the walls white. I mean, they were purple, they were orange, they were green, they were blue, they were yellow. I didn't know that I would have to look into the eyes of my daughter and say goodbye, knowing that I might not ever see her again. Thank God some people have helped me. I get to go home usually twice a year. Thank God that I may never see my grandson. Halfway down to Illinois from Texas, I stopped at a motel with my friend, and I went in the bathroom. And see, I'm not like my friend Rena. Rena puddles and leaks, and I don't do that. You know, I'm in the bathroom where Rena would be puddling in a leak, and I guess most people leak in bathrooms, don't they? But she does a different kind of leaking, you know? And I'm biting the sides of my hand, and I'm saying, God, you know, all my sponsorees, my other sponsor, my AA group, and I'm going to Illinois, I don't know that I can do it. I don't know that I want to do it. And I remember, because I've lost a tremendous amount of weight, and I'm extremely frail. And that's not a pity thing, it's just a reality, I'm frail. I got to Illinois, and I thought, well, the next right thing is to go to meetings. And I went to a group, and I introduced myself. They didn't like me. And I went to another group, and I introduced myself, and they didn't like me. And I thought, oh, what's the matter? And at this second group I went to, I was at a meeting, and they were talking about being the friendliest group in Wonder Lake, and I raised my hand. I said, excuse me, y'all are lying to yourselves. You're not friendly at all. I've been coming here. You won't give me your phone numbers. You don't talk to me. And they were intimidated because of the length of sobriety that I had. You know, don't treat new people in your group. Just because I had 33 years, I wasn't interested in running an AA group. I needed an AA home. I needed the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to be there for me. The room I'm in now is my hospice room. And it's real small, but I look out the windows. It's got like 13 windows. And I see hummingbirds playing with one another. And I see cardinals, and I see blue jays, and I see sparrows. And they've got dogs. And I've got 5 chickens, the most beautiful chickens you could ever see. I go to bed at night listening to the coyotes. Can you imagine? I wake up to the tune of the rooster, and I hear the donkey braying in the neighbor's yard. You know, I will tell you, every promise that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous made has came true. Every promise and then some. I'm not what I used to be, y'all. I'm not what I'm going to be. My hands are clean before God today because I haven't stolen anything from any of y'all. My hands are clean before God today because your men are safe with me. Don't misunderstand me. Cancer and frailty has not stopped my natural basic desire for sex. But I have a standard to live up to. That's the part I resent about my sponsor. So my hands are clean before God. I'm going to share with you about the most magnificent giver I ever saw in my life, and then I will get down and leave you alone. I was at Harbor Club, and a gentleman came in off the street. He was one of those that people look around and you really don't want him to be a part of your group. He had the shaved head, the scabs in the head, had a little brown paper sack. It was all wadded up at the top. And he walked over to a table full of the men, and he said, would you all like a donut? They all said no. He came to my table. Now, these donuts were wadded up. You know, he'd been gnawing a little probably. And he looked at me and he said, "Lady, would you like one of my donuts?" I said, "Yes, sir, I would." And he opened up that bag and I said, "Would it bother you if I took this donut to school? I have to pick up my daughter," and shared it with her. He said, "No." I took that donut. He gave me the whole bag. He said, "You can have the whole bag." I took those donuts. I went and picked my daughter up at school. And we went to the duck pond and fed the ducks. But let me tell you what that man did. Number one, he gave everything he had to give. He gave everything. And he didn't stop giving until somebody learned to accept what he had to give. Just recently, I turned 64. And I got some beautiful gifts and some beautiful cards. My daughter sent me a birthday card in the mail. It said, "Dear Mama, seems like it's been so long since you've been gone. Time flies. I have to tell you how much I've learned from you, a woman with a fourth grade education. I've learned how to be strong. And above and beyond that, Mama, I've learned that God is always there for me. Today, I am a woman of dignity, and I am an awesome woman because of you, Mama." And you know how she signed it? "I love you, Mommy." You know, my child, the little girl that should have been working the streets at the age of 12, the little girl that should have been kicked upside the head, the little girl that's a good student, she's going to school again, a good employee, a good mama, a good neighbor, a good citizen. My life is probably the richest of anyone you're ever going to meet. You may meet people that have more money. But you know what? My cup is full and running over. We know. Alcoholics Anonymous knows. We were blind and now we see. We were lame and now we walk. You know, I used to pray for God, grant mercy on me, justice on them, but mercy on me. And I've changed. I ask God to be merciful to each and every one of us. And I find that mercy by practicing the last three steps of the program of recovery. Once again, I want to thank you for having me here. Thank you for listening to me. Thank you for bringing me here. Thank you for wanting me here.